There's a home for little children above the bright blue sky. It's picture language, of course. Not very helpful nowadays, with children aware of the realities of space travel and the nature of the universe and modern astronomy and all the wonders of the universe they see on television. Yuri Gagarin, the first person to go into space, was reported in the Russian media as saying on his return, "I've been into space and God is not there." Maybe he'd learnt a Russian version of "There's a home for little children above the bright blue sky" and taken it literally. I think it's significant that the story of Jesus' ascension in Acts 1:9 doesn't have Jesus disappearing into the sky and keep on going like the rockets we see on TV from Cape Canaveral until he just dwindles away. No, he disappears into a cloud and is not seen anymore. The point being made is that he's gone from earth to heaven, not the direction in which he went. So, where is heaven? Perhaps the best answer is that to be in heaven is to be in the immediate presence of God. And that word "immediate" is important. The Bible makes it clear that in a sense, in this life, we are always in the presence of God. In the Great Commission, at the end of Matthew's Gospel, Jesus promises that he'll be with his disciples always. However, that presence is mediated to us by the Holy Spirit in a kind of attenuated form, you might say. Being sinful, fallen creatures, we couldn't bear being in the immediate presence of God. Those people in the Bible who did have special experiences of God's presence, like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, the Apostle Paul, found it an almost unbearable experience. Heaven, then, is the immediate presence of God. "But Daddy," I can imagine the awkward child saying, "where is that?" The simple answer is, I don't know now. I'm sure it's not anywhere in this universe which our telescopes might be able to show us one day. It's not part of a physical reality that we can explore. But having said that, there's nothing more I can say now. But the Bible does tell us where heaven will be in eternity. And it's an answer that seems to surprise some Christians. I find that many Christians think that the heaven in which we'll be for eternity has nothing to do with this earth in which we are spending our life now. But that's not what John saw in that vision we had read to us from Revelation 21. Yes, he saw a new heaven and a new earth, and a holy city coming down from heaven to earth, to the new earth. And it's in that city, he tells us, that God will dwell forever with men and women. Heaven comes down to earth, a new earth. And the word that John uses for new is important. We've only got one word for new in English. But in Greek, the language of the New Testament, there are two words for new. One of them means something which has never existed before. And that's not the word that John uses. The other word means something that has a different quality about it. And that is the word that John's inspired to use. He's telling us that the new earth is a transformed version of the old, not that the old has been destroyed and done away with and something completely new has been created. Now, of course, what John sees is also picture language. It's a vision that's a picture, because the future is so amazing and mind-bending that it can't be described in a way we could easily understand. So we get this picture. It's a description of a city, but the elements of the picture are important. It's a city that has many echoes of the description of the Garden of Eden. I wonder whether you picked some of them up. There's precious stones. There's a river. There's the tree of life. But it's not a garden. It's a city. A garden city, perhaps you might say. In Genesis 2, it's God who plants a garden. In Genesis 4, it's a man, Cain, who builds the first city. Cities are a human invention. And human culture develops in them. We're told of this new city, this holy city, that the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. Isn't this telling us that when God transforms this earth, he'll take up all that's been good and worthwhile in human endeavour and give it a place in the new earth, the new city? We are contributing to that by what we do now, if we're doing it for God. It's a mind-boggling thought, but an important one. Non-Christians are looking for meaning and purpose in life, something to make it all worthwhile. All too often, Christians seem to give the impression that there's no meaning or purpose in it all, in the sense God's going to wipe it out, and all that matters is saving people's immortal and immaterial souls. But that's not biblical. As we shall see later, the Bible doesn't talk about immortal and immaterial souls. It talks about resurrected bodies. Nor does it talk about God wiping out all that we've done in this life on earth. Rather, what we do with and on this earth can be of eternal significance. The way we care for and develop the earth and its resources. What we do with the gifts and talents that God has given us in all sorts of different ways, art, music, literature, science, technology, as well as bringing people to faith in Christ and through Christ, salvation. If it's been done in obedience to God and for his glory, all this will be taken up by God and made part of that transformed new earth. It'll have its place in that new Jerusalem. You see, God hasn't created a kind of throwaway earth or given us throwaway lives. You might say he's going to recycle both. And the amazing truth is that we can make a contribution to what's recycled when God comes to dwell with men and women and heaven comes down to earth. I said it's mind-boggling, so we're going to pause and think about it by singing a hymn, one you may not know very well, but I'm sure the music group will be able to lead us. It's in many ways just a paraphrase of that chapter in Revelation. Then I saw a new heaven and earth.
Temple.
Short notice and leading us in it. For a number of years, I worked at what was called the Institute of Contemporary Christianity in London, seeking to help people apply their faith to their everyday life and work, and did quite a lot of work with doctors and medics and nurses. And in one of those short courses we did for health professionals, a nurse gave us this poem. She said it had been printed in the Nursing Mirror, not a journal I read regularly. It's not great poetry, but it says something very important. It's written by a patient. I huddle inside my corner bed, watching the other patients sipping tea. I wonder why I'm so long getting well and why it is no one talks to me. The nurses are so kind, they brush my hair on days I feel too ill to read or sew. I smile and chat and try not to show my fear, but they will not tell me what I want to know. The visitors come in, I see their eyes becoming embarrassed as they pass my bed. What lovely flowers, they say, and hurry on in case their faces show what can't be said. The chaplain passes on his weekly round with friendly smile and calm, untroubled brow. He speaks with deep sincerity of life. I want to speak of death. Don't know how. The surgeon comes with student retinue, mutters to sister deaf to my mute plea. I want to tell the dread I feel inside, but they're all too kind to talk to me. It's sometimes said that death is the one remaining taboo subject in our society. Try talking about it at coffee time at work or when talking to neighbours in the supermarket. The fact is, people are afraid of death. That is why so much money, research and technology is going into postponing it or trying to postpone it. And part of the reason is people are unsure what, if anything, awaits them beyond death. The Apostle Paul wasn't afraid of death. He was sure that for him, death would mean being with Christ. For me to live is Christ, he said, and to die is gain. That's clearly the message that he passed on to his followers, to those who were brought to faith, his converts. But some of them found it difficult to accept this teaching, difficult to take it in. The Corinthians had a problem with it. And we should have read 1 Corinthians 15 before I started this. So at this point, I'm going to ask Shirley to come and read it for us. Thank you.
This is 1 Corinthians 15:35-49. But someone may ask, how are the dead raised? What kind of body will they come? How foolish. What you sow does not come to life unless it dies. When you sow, you do not plant the body that will be, but just a seed, perhaps of wheat or of something else. But God gives it a body as he has determined, and to each kind of seed he gives its own body. All flesh is not the same. Men have one kind of flesh, animals have another, birds another, and fish another. There are also heavenly bodies and there are earthly bodies. But the splendour of the heavenly bodies is one kind, and the splendour of the earthly bodies is another. The sun has one kind of splendour, the moon another, and the stars another, and star differs from star in splendour. So will it be with the resurrection of the dead. The body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown in dishonour, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. So it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living thing. The last man, Adam, a life-giving spirit. The spiritual did not come first, but the natural, and after that the spiritual. The first man was of the dust of the earth, the second man from heaven. As was the earthly man, so were those who were of the earth. And as is the man from heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. And just as we have borne the likeness of the earthly man, so shall we bear the likeness of the man from heaven.
Thank you very much. So the Corinthians had a problem. What does resurrection mean? They were saying. What kind of existence will we live and have after death? I'm sure common sense told them that they weren't going to be resuscitated corpses, some kind of zombies, if you like. But they couldn't imagine what else it might mean. We find the same sort of thing today, don't we? People will say stupid things like, I don't want to spend eternity on a cloud playing a harp. Well, it's picture language, childish picture. Another warning, we need to be careful what picture language we use when talking to children, because others pick it up. And it becomes a stumbling block, unless we can give some clear alternative. So how does Paul answer the Corinthians' question? He says three things in the passage that we read. First of all, he talks about a resurrection body. And that was, in fact, part of their problem. The Corinthians were Greeks, and they'd been brought up with the Greek idea of that any existence beyond death must be a disembodied existence, disembodied spirit or soul. Because many Greek philosophers had taught that matter is inherently evil. I won't go into the reasons for that, but that's what they taught. And so salvation for them meant escaping from the material body, not living in it for eternity. However, the idea of existing for eternity as a disembodied spirit or soul is not biblical. The Old Testament doesn't make any sharp division between body, soul, and spirit. It presents the human person as a unified whole, yes, with different aspects, but not different bits, different parts. And matter is good, because God created matter, and when he created it, he said it's good. And so, when the understanding of life after death does become clear in the Old Testament, it's life as a resurrected person in a renewed body. That teaching is only found right at the end of the Old Testament in terms of the dates of the life of the books. It's found in Daniel chapter 12, the only clear place where it is said we will be resurrected and have new glorified bodies. And in the time of Jesus, not all the Jews believed that. The Sadducees didn't believe it. The Pharisees did. In the Gospels, we see that Jesus sided with the Pharisees. And so did Paul. Now, can you see how this fits with what I said earlier? It's all part of the way the Bible teaches us to take the physical, material world seriously. As God's good creation, that yes, it's been spoilt, but it will be renewed, not discarded or destroyed. The new heaven and the new earth that we thought about will be the home for us in our resurrected bodies. So Paul insists there will be a resurrection body. However, as we were reminded earlier, this will be different from our present bodies. But Paul says there will be both continuity and change. It's not easy to grasp this, so he uses picture language. We had it read to us in verses 37 and 38. He says, "And as for what you sow, you don't sow the body that's to be, but a bare seed, perhaps of wheat or some other grain. But God gives it a body as he has chosen, and to each kind of seed, its own body." So Paul's using picture language here to say the resurrection body is different from our present body, but it's related to our present body. An experienced gardener, and that doesn't include me, an experienced gardener can look at a bulb and say, well, this will grow into a daffodil, or this will be a tulip, or whatever, even though the bulb looks quite different from the flowering plant that's going to come from it. There is continuity, but there is change. And the continuity links the two together. This is something we can only marvel at. So is it surprising that the idea of having a resurrection body that's both continuous with but different from our present body is mind-stretching? We see something, though, of that continuity and change in our own lives, don't we? Hazel and I have been going through some old photographs recently, and we got photographs of our two sons from, well, just a few weeks, if not days after their birth, to the adults that they now are in their 40s. And there is change, but there's continuity. You can see at different points the things that resemble what they are now or what they were when they were babies. And so perhaps we can say that the same is true with what's going to happen with us in the resurrection. The resurrection is just, if you like, the next stage of the process of change, even though it's going to be a much bigger change as we are glorified in our resurrection bodies. But Paul makes another important point about this change later on. He says that God gives each of his creatures a unique, recognisable body in this life. And so it may sound a little bit strange to us what he says in verses 39 and onwards. He says there are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. The glory of the heavenly is one thing and the earthly is another. There's one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. Indeed, star differs from star in glory. Why is he saying this? Well, he's saying there are lots of different kinds of bodies, each appropriate for what they embody, and they've all got their own sort of glory. But God gives each of his creatures a unique, recognisable body in this life. So he'll do the same in the next life. We'll all have unique but recognisable bodies in the life that is to come. Now, we're going to, he says, remain unique, recognisable individuals. But this raises lots of questions, doesn't it? Will my resurrection body be like the one I had in the prime of life when I might have been able to run marathons? Well, I did do cross-country running, but never marathons. Or the failing one that I may have at the time of my death? Will it have the scars I've accumulated during my life? What about the various disabilities I've had? We've all got some. You can see one of mine. I have to wear glasses. That's a disability with my eyes. Will they disappear? If it's a transformed body, how will other people recognise me? And how will I recognise them? Does it matter whether I'm buried or cremated? Let's take that last question first, because I think it's possibly the easiest one to answer. The fact is that buried bodies disintegrate, just like cremated ones. They just take longer to do so, because the disintegration is due to things like bacteria and grubs instead of fire. I'm not sure that God has any need of the original materials or bits to resurrect me, and if he does, I'm sure he can gather them from wherever necessary. But I've no simple answer to the other questions, only a couple of observations. The first is that recognising people is a very varied thing and doesn't necessarily involve the physical body at all. You can pick up the phone and recognise someone by their voice without ever seeing them. What's more, someone may read an extract from a letter to you, and you can recognise who wrote the letter from the way things are expressed, although it comes to you in a different voice. You can walk into an empty room and see a lovely flower arrangement and say, "Ah, oh, Mary must have done that." Or you can come home from work and looking at the mess in the living room and say, "Ah, oh, John's come home from college." Perhaps from those kinds of examples we get a glimpse of how we might recognise one another in our transformed, resurrected state. The second observation is that Jesus' resurrection body, as we've been reminded again, the body in which he ascended to heaven, had the scars of the crucifixion. But they weren't now a cause of shame or limitation, but grounds of glory. And maybe that's a clue that the signs in our physical bodies of all that was good and worthwhile in our earthly existence will be taken with us. And we might be surprised at what some of those signs are. What might have seemed a disability or limitation of this life might become a ground of glory because of the way we used it or coped with it. And it seems to me that's part of what Paul is saying when he goes on in 1 Corinthians 15 to say, what is sown as a physical body is raised as a spiritual body. If there's a physical body, there's also a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man Adam became a living being, the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it's not the spiritual that's first, but the physical, and then the spiritual. As the man of dust, so are those who are dust. As the man of heaven, so are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we'll also bear the image of the man of heaven. There will be that continuity and yet change. And that brings us to Paul's last point. Ultimately, the essence of resurrection is being with Christ and being like Christ. Christ was recognisably the same Jesus, but he was glorified. As we've been told, he wasn't immediately recognised. But then there was something about the way he did things, or something he said, one of those, if you might, intangible things, which then made them think, yeah, it is Jesus. And then he showed them the scars. And so they knew he was Jesus. But different. He could appear, as we heard, in locked rooms. He returned to heaven. But the most important thing is he was recognisably the same Jesus, but glorified. And this, says Paul, is the evidence of what God intends for us as human beings. We are all born as descendants of Adam, with the same kind of physical body he had. Jesus came as the last Adam, the one who makes possible the final stage of that development that begins in this life, to be creatures made in the image and likeness of God. And that image was marred by Adam and Eve's sin. Through Jesus' sacrifice and resurrection into glory, we've that image restored to us, gradually now in this life, but in fullness in the life to come, as we're transformed into the likeness of Christ. So eternal life is not just survival through death. It means entering a new transformed existence in which we reach God's intended purpose for us as we share the glory of the risen Christ. Amen. So, what do we need to fear death? Here's a reflection by Bishop Charles Brent. What is dying? I'm standing on the seashore. A ship sails to the morning breeze and starts for the ocean. She's an object of beauty, and I stand watching her till at last she fades on the horizon. Someone at my side says, "She's gone." "Gone? Where?" "Gone from my sight, that's all." She's just as large in the mast, hull and spars as she was when I saw her, just as able to bear her load of living freight to its destination. The diminished size and total loss of sight is in me, not in her. And just at the moment someone at my side says she's gone, there are others who are watching her coming, and other voices say, "There she comes." That's dying. So let's sing our final hymn, which is "Thine Be the Glory."